You're listening to The Philosopher's Note on the Happiness Hypothesis. More wisdom in less time.
Hi, this is Brian. Welcome to The Philosopher's Notes on the Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom by Jonathan Haidt. We'll start with a quote, as always. Where does happiness come from? There are several different happiness hypotheses. One is that happiness comes from getting what you want, but we all know and research confirms that such happiness is short-lived. A more promising hypothesis is that happiness comes from within and cannot be obtained by making the world conform to your desires. This idea was widespread in the ancient world. Buddha in India and the Stoic philosophers in ancient Greece and Rome all counseled people to break their emotional attachments to people and events, which are always unpredictable and uncontrollable, and to cultivate instead an attitude of acceptance. This ancient idea deserves respect, and it is certainly true that changing your mind is usually a more effective response to frustration than is changing the world. However, I will present evidence that this second version of the happiness hypothesis is wrong. Recent research shows that there are some things worth striving for. There are some external conditions of life that can make you lastingly happier. One of these conditions is relatedness, the bonds we form and need to form with others. I'll present research showing where love comes from, why passionate love always cools, and what kind of love is true love. I'll suggest that the happiness hypothesis offered by Buddha and the Stoics should be amended. Happiness comes from within, and happiness comes from without. We need the guidance of both ancient wisdom and modern science to get the balance right. End quote. That is Jonathan Haidt from the Happiness Hypothesis. And that's officially the longest intro quote of any of the notes I've created so far. But oh my God, makes you want to read the whole book, huh? Jonathan Haidt is a leading positive psychology researcher slash professor at the University of Virginia. And this book is an incredible look at 10 great ideas from ancient wisdom that he brilliantly analyzes in the light of modern science, while helping us apply the super practical stuff to our 21st century lives. It's a great blend of intellectual rigor, philosophical wisdom, and nuts and bolts practicality that I highly recommend. If this note resonates with you, I definitely think you'll love the book. I put it up there with Sonia Lyubomirsky's How of Happiness and Tal Ben-Shahar's Pursuit of Perfect and Happier as some must-read positive psychology goodness. If you could see my copy of the book, you'd see that a lot of it is highlighted. It's packed with goodness. Picking the gems to share was a bit of a challenge, but I hope you love my selections, and here's to rocking our happiness. The first big idea is the rider and the elephant. Quote, Freud said that the mind is divided into three parts, the ego, the conscious, rational self, the superego, the conscience, a sometimes too rigid commitment to the rules of society, and the id, the desire for pleasure, lots of it, sooner rather than later. The metaphor I use when I lecture on Freud is to think of the mind as a horse and buggy, a Victorian chariot, in which the driver, the ego, struggles frantically to control a hungry, lustful, and disobedient horse, the id, while the driver's father, the superego, sits in the back seat lecturing the driver on what he's doing wrong. For Freud, the goal of psychoanalysis was to escape this pitiful state by strengthening the ego, thus giving it more control over the id and more independence from the superego. End quote. The first chapter is all about the divided self, where Haidt presents the model of the rider and the elephant, which is based on metaphors used by Buddha and Plato that compare our rational slash conscious minds with the more animalistic instincts that tend to run the show. The rider and the elephant appear throughout the book, and there's actually an entire book on it called Switch, which I'll probably do a note on as well. For now, let's jump into some big ideas on how to ride that elephant skillfully. Next big idea is epiphanies and lasting change. quote, if you have ever achieved such dramatic insights into your life and resolved to change your ways or your outlook, you probably found that 3 months later, you were right back where you started. Epiphanies can be life-altering, but most fade in days or weeks. The writer can't just decide to change and then order the elephant to go along with the program. Lasting change can come only by retraining the elephant, and that's hard to do. When pop psychology programs are successful in helping people, which they sometimes are, they succeed not because of the initial moment of insight, but because they find ways to alter people's behavior over the following months. They keep people involved with the program long enough to retrain the elephant. End quote. As we know and talked about in depth in the note on Ken Wilber, it's one thing to have a huge aha moment of inspiration and clarity. It's an entirely different thing to actually translate that epiphany into lasting change, alchemizing an inspired state experience into a trait of who we are. In Haidt's language, we've got to train the elephant, and that takes time, which is why we always come back to the idea of working diligently, patiently, persistently, and playfully. Next big idea is the magic pill of meditation. Quote, suppose you read about a pill that you could take once a day to reduce anxiety and increase your contentment. Would you take it? Suppose further that the pill has a great variety of side effects, all of them good. Increased self-esteem, empathy, and trust. It even improves memory. Suppose, finally, that the pill is all natural and costs nothing. Now would you take it? The pill exists. It's called meditation. End quote. I love that. So would you take that pill? And more importantly, are you? We talk about meditation in the notes on Eknath Eswaran's Conquest of Mind, Herbert Benson's The Relaxation Revolution, and Jon Kabat-Zinn's Wherever You Go, There You Are, plus many others. So check those out along with our new www.blissitations.com website for more goodness on the specifics of meditation. But know this, meditation, along with cognitive therapy, is one of the most effective natural ways to change your mind. Which naturally brings us to the next big idea, which is cognitive therapy. Quote, meditation is a characteristically Eastern solution to the problems of life. Even before Buddha, the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu had said that the road to wisdom runs through calm inaction, desireless wanting. Western approaches to problems more typically involve pulling out a toolbox and trying to fix what's broken. That was Lady Philosophy's approach with her many arguments and reframing techniques. The toolbox was thoroughly modernized in the 1960s by Aaron Beck. End quote. After seeing that traditional Freudian psychotherapy was often making his patients feel worse, Aaron Beck created cognitive therapy, which is, according to Haidt, quote, one of the most effective treatments available for depression, anxiety, and many other problems. End quote. Cool. So what exactly is cognitive therapy? Haidt says, quote, depressed people are caught in a feedback loop in which distorted thoughts cause negative feelings, which then distort thinking further. Beck's discovery is that you can break the cycle by changing the thoughts. A big part of cognitive therapy is training clients to catch their thoughts, write them down, name the distortions, and then find alternative and more accurate ways of thinking. Over many weeks, the client's anxiety or depression abates. Cognitive therapy works because it teaches the writer how to train the elephant rather than how to defeat it directly in an argument. That is powerful stuff. If you're currently or ever in a depressive funk, you probably notice that you've got some renegade negative thoughts spiraling out of control in that little noggin of yours. Rather than worrying about performing a Freudian archaeological dig on why those thoughts are there, cognitive therapy tells us to catch the negative thoughts, identify the distortions, and find more accurate and empowering ways of thinking. The trick in retraining the elephant is to do this often. Whenever we're feeling funky, we want to train ourselves to stop and notice our thoughts, challenge them, and see if we can create alternative, more empowering ways of thinking. As we do this day in and day out, the elephant gets retrained. Our depression releases its grip on us, and we've got another handy tool in the happiness toolbox. One more note. Cognitive therapy has been extended to what is now called cognitive behavioral therapy, where we not only challenge the thoughts, but we choose more empowering behaviors when we're feeling the funk. So, for example, when you're feeling icky and just want to pull the covers over your head, Haight tells us that you might want to check out your thoughts and engage in simple tasks, like going out and buying a newspaper rather than staying in bed ruminating all day long, which we know from our note on the How of Happiness is definitely not a good idea. All right, the next big idea is pulling the splinter. Quote, try this now. Think of a recent interpersonal conflict with someone you care about, and then find one way in which your behavior was not exemplary. Maybe you did something insensitive, even if you had a right to do it, or hurtful, even if you meant well, or inconsistent with your principles, even though you can readily justify it. When you first catch sight of a fault in yourself, you'll likely hear frantic arguments from your inner lawyer to find at least one thing that you did wrong. When you extract a splinter, it hurts, briefly, but then you feel relief, even pleasure. When you find fault in yourself, it will hurt, briefly, but if you keep going and acknowledge the fault, you are likely to be rewarded with a flash of pleasure that is mixed, oddly, with a hint of pride. It is the pleasure of taking responsibility for your own behavior. It is the feeling of honor. End quote. Love that. And as it turns out, I read this passage this morning after my love and I had a bit of a frustrating evening the night before. To put it in perspective, we usually end our nightly appreciations with a list of cool things we really appreciate about the other one, and then ending with, and I appreciate that you're my wife, husband, amen. So we do a bunch of things. I appreciate this and this and this and this about you and this and this, and I appreciate that you're my wife / husband, amen. Last night's entire appreciation sharing was, Alexandra, I appreciate that you're my husband, amen. And me, I appreciate that you're my wife, amen. In other words, we didn't do any of the other appreciations. But anyway, we started our morning a little distant. And as I was flipping through this book, preparing to write this note, I came across this really big idea. Amazing. Within seconds, I could see where I was at fault and went over and apologized and wha-bam, all good. How about you? Do you have any relationships that could use this analysis? Get on it. Pull the splinter, wince at the pain, then feel the pleasure of taking responsibility for your life. Big stuff. All right, the next big idea is cruising for love. Quote, if you want to predict how happy someone is or how long she will live, and if you are not allowed to ask about her genes or personality, you should find out about her social relationships. Having strong social relationships strengthens the immune system, extends life, more than does quitting smoking, speeds recovery from surgery, and reduces the risks of depression and anxiety disorders. It's not just that extroverts are naturally happier and healthier. When introverts are forced to be more outgoing, they usually enjoy it and find that it boosts their mood. Even people who think they don't want a lot of social contact still benefit from it. And it's not just that we all need somebody to lean on. Recent work on giving support shows that caring for others is often more beneficial than is receiving help. We need to interact and intertwine with others. We need the give and the take. We need to belong. An ideology of extreme personal freedom can be dangerous because it encourages people to leave homes, jobs, cities, and marriages in search of personal and professional fulfillment, thereby breaking the relationships that were probably their best hope for such fulfillment. End quote. Well, that puts things in perspective, huh? I know for me that in pursuit of certain ideals, it's been easy to forget to invest energy into relationships. How about you? How can you invest more of your time and love and energy into your family and friends and community? Well, for me, I've got a big smile right now. My answer to that question, among many other little things, is this. Alexander and I are surprising my mom on a cruise in a few weeks. Although far from wealthy, my incredibly sweet and generous mama wanted to bring our entire family together for a special week-long cruise and paid for 19 members of our family. I have 3 sisters and a brother and 9 nephews / nieces to go. Other than my nephew who just started college, Alexandra and I were going to be the only 2 to miss the event as we were in Bali and, well, just aren't that into cruises. But redefining what's important to us and deciding that spending more time with our friends and family is a top priority, we decided to come home early and surprise her. I get tears in my eyes as I typed that, imagining how cool it was going to be. And I can tell you, we had the special event. We surprised her, and it was awesome. Super heart-opening and fantastic. But let's get back to you. How are you going to invest more love and kindness and generosity and presence and goodness into your relationships? Huh? How are you going to do it? And next big idea, how's your vertical coherence? Quote, the psychologists Ken Sheldon and Tim Kasser have found that people who are mentally healthy and happier have a higher degree of vertical coherence among their goals. That is, higher level, long-term goals and lower level, immediate goals all fit together well, so that pursuing one's short-term goals advances the pursuit of long-term goals, end quote. I love this. I actually did a video on something similar to this earlier this year that shows how I do my planning, goal setting, etc. Got to record another one going through this process specifically, but check out tv.philosophersnotes.com for all my videos, or you can subscribe on the iTunes video podcast we have. Just search for Philosopher's Notes, and you can one-click download over 100 episodes. Anyway, when I do goals journaling, I start with my uber big picture vision and intention, integrating the eulogy exercise we talk about in the note on Stephen Covey's 7 Habits, plus an exercise I call My Wishes, which is based on Gay Hendricks' book, 5 Wishes. The funeral eulogy exercise is an awesome way for me to get clear on my highest virtues and how I want people to think of and remember me. Check out the note on the 7 Habits for more on that. For the My Wishes exercise, I do this. Imagine you're on your deathbed sometime in the distant future. Someone asks you, do you have any regrets? Think about what you wish you would have done that you have yet to do. Those are pretty important things, huh? For those curious souls, I hereby share my current would be bummed if I didn't do these before I die wishes. Number one, I want to have awesome kids and be an extraordinary father. Number two, I want to continue to have an awesome relationship with Alexandra and be an extraordinary husband. And number three, I want to feel like I really lived and embodied my virtues and that I made a significant difference in the world. How about you? How would you respond to those My Wishes questions? So that's kind of the top level, right? From there, I have fun identifying my rough one-decade goals. Then, with some more clarity, I identify my one-year goals. And then I laser in on my one-quarter, one-month, one-week, one-day, today's number one goal. Then, I identify the key disciplines I need to rock in order to most powerfully show up in pursuit of those goals. Stuff like daily meditation and exercise, eating well, appreciation, and creating. As I map these out in my journal, I can see that they're all integrated, or as researchers describe it, vertically coherent. My near-term goals are congruent with my long-term goals. Might have been difficult to follow, so I want to make sure I do a video on it, but how about you? How's your vertical coherence? Are your long-term and your short-term goals aligned? It's important to make it so. And as you do that, how about this next big idea? Get your virtue on. Quote, what was his, this is Benjamin Franklin's, secret? Virtue. Not the sort of uptight, pleasure-hating Puritanism that some people now associate with that word, but a broader kind of virtue that goes back to ancient Greece. The Greek word arete means excellence, virtue, or goodness, especially of a functional sort. Thus, in saying that well-being or happiness, eudaimonia, is an activity of soul in conformity with excellence or virtue, Aristotle wasn't saying that happiness comes from giving to the poor and suppressing your sexuality. He was saying that a good life is one where you develop your strengths, realize your potential, and become what it is in your nature to become. End quote. Ah, the Greek ideal of virtue. I love it. In fact, before Philosopher's Notes, my site was called thinkarete.com, and the final chapter of my book is called Think Arete, The Manifesto. Check that out. And if you Google Think Arete, The Manifesto YouTube, you can find a really cool video one of our fans did a while back. But anyway, for the Greeks, it was quite simple. If we want happiness, we need to live with arte, striving to live at our highest potential, moment to moment to moment. Good times. All right, the final big idea here is sidestepping elephant poop. Quote, Aristotle asked about arete, excellence and virtue, and telos, purpose and goals. And he used the metaphor that people are like archers who need a clear target at which to aim. Without a target or goal, one is left with the animal default. Just let the elephant graze or roam where he pleases. And because elephants live in herds, one ends up doing what everyone else is doing. End quote. So, what is your vision of your highest self? And what are your goals to achieve that ideal? Let's get clear on our ultimate purpose and move toward it, lest we step in other people's elephant poop. Don't want to do that. That wraps it up, but plus there's a little P.S. P.S., here's Haight's version of the ultimate happiness hypothesis. He says, quote, I don't believe there is an inspiring answer to the question, what is the purpose of life? Yet by drawing on ancient wisdom and modern science, we can find compelling answers to the question of purpose within life. The final version of the happiness hypothesis is that happiness comes from between. Happiness is not something you can find, acquire, or achieve directly. You have to get the conditions right and then wait. Some of those conditions are within you, such as coherence among the parts and levels of your personality. Other conditions require relationships to things beyond you. Just as plants need sun, water, and good soil to thrive, people need love, work, and a connection to something larger. It is worth striving to get the right relationships between yourself and others, between yourself and your work, and between yourself and something larger than yourself. If you can get these relationships right, a sense of purpose and meaning will emerge. End quote. Well, that's a quick look at this great book. I really, really recommend The Happiness Hypothesis by Jonathan Haight. Check it out if you really resonated with this note. I think you'll love the book. Let's look at a quick bio of Jonathan and some other notes I think you'll like, and then some sidebar quotes, and we will call it a day. So Jonathan Haight is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. His research examines the emotional basis of morality and the ways that morality varies across cultures, including the cultures of liberals and conservatives. He's the co-editor of Flourishing, Positive Psychology and the Life Well Lived. He lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. For further information on topics discussed in the book, check out happinesshypothesis.com. That's from the book. If you like this note, I think you'll definitely like The How of Happiness, if you haven't read it yet, Happier, The Note on the Pursuit of Perfect, Flow, Authentic Happiness, and Man's Search for Meaning. Now we shall have fun with these sidebar quotes. Haight says this, quote, in the positive psychology class I teach at the University of Virginia, the final project is to make yourself a better person, using all the tools of psychology, and then prove that you have done so. Love that. Where was that class at my university? Oh, wait, positive psychology wasn't around then. Anyway, back to the quotes. If you are a pessimist, you are probably feeling gloomy right now, but despair not. The key to growth is not optimism per se. It is the sense making that optimists find easy. If you can find a way to make sense of adversity and draw constructive lessons from it, you can benefit too. Adversity may be necessary for growth because it forces you to stop speeding along the road of life, allowing you to notice the paths that were branching off all along and to think about where you really want to end up. Seneca was right. No one can live happily who has regard to himself alone and transforms everything into a question of his own utility. You can increase your happiness if you use your strengths, particularly in the service of strengthening connections, helping friends, expressing gratitude to benefactors. The big finding was that people experienced longer-lasting improvements in mood from the kindness and gratitude activities than from those in which they indulged themselves. And finally, we got two more. We get more pleasure from making progress toward our goal than we do from achieving them because, as Shakespeare said, joy's soul lies in the doing. Last quote, work at its best then is about connection, engagement, and commitment. As the poet Khalil Gibran said, work is love made visible. Oops, we got one more. When Freud was asked what a normal person should be able to do well, he is reputed to have said, love and work. Well, there you go. Here's to love and work and rocking our own happiness hypothesis. Hope you dug the note. Hope you're doing great. Look forward to sharing more with you soon. In the meantime, have an awesome day. See ya.
We hope you enjoyed this Philosopher's Note. Please go to www.philosophersnotes.com to download more.